Lattimore versus State of Nevada, case number 81343. Justice Herndon is disqualified in this case. As well, as I mentioned earlier, Justice Stiglitz is participating by video conference. And I don't believe Justice Silver is disqualified on this case. At least I didn't see any recusal from her. And so she too, as I mentioned earlier, will be listening to the oral argument and participating in conference when we get to that stage. All right, are you ready to proceed, Ms. Westbrook?
I'm ready.
Yes, you may.
May it please the court, justices, my name is Deborah Westbrook from the Public Defender's Office on behalf of the appellant Kenya Lattimore. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Kenya is now serving an 8 to 20 year sentence in Nevada's prison system as a result of a trial and a sentencing procedure that were fundamentally unfair and that violated his constitutional rights. There are many issues in this case, but I want to start today by addressing the court's error in refusing to admit evidence of Kenya's 61 IQ. That error in and of itself, I believe, is reversible. But I will also address how that error operated in conjunction with multiple other trial errors to render Kenya's trial fundamentally unfair. And if there's time, I'll also address the sentencing issue and why the COVID-19 pandemic does not excuse what happened in this case. Shortly before the November 2019 trial setting, defense counsel received a report from Dr. Harder about Kenya's IQ that caused the court to vacate the trial setting and refer Kenya to competency proceedings. Although Kenya was later found competent, Dr. Harder's report contained information that was directly relevant to the defense. The report indicated that Kenya was a slow learner and in special education classes growing up, that he had an IQ of 61 that put him in the intellectual disability range, that compared with other adults his age, he scored better than only 5 out of 1,000. And Dr. Harder concluded that the low score could explain Kenya's poor decision-making and potentially be used for mitigating his case. So, of course, Kenya noticed Dr. Harder as a trial expert. The state moved to strike Dr. Harder on the basis of the adequacy of the expert notice, but crucially, the court did not find the notice inadequate, and the court didn't find any bad faith or prejudice to the state either. Instead, prior to trial, the court had the parties address the relevance of Dr. Harder's testimony about Kenya's intellect. And in briefing at several hearings, Kenya's attorneys told the state and the court exactly how they intended to use Dr. Harder's testimony. At trial, Kenya was going to argue that the battery was justified and that the reason he ran into his mother Mary's bedroom and hit his stepfather over the head with a bat was because, as a result of his low IQ, he misread the situation that was occurring and he believed that his mother needed him to defend her. Kenya was also going to use the same evidence to argue that he did not specifically intend to obstruct the course of justice when he called his parents. Instead, he was simply trying to relay information that he had received from his attorneys, and he either misunderstood that information or miscommunicated it as a result of his cognitive abilities. But the court ruled that Kenya could not introduce any evidence of his IQ for one reason and one reason only, and that's because Nevada doesn't recognize a diminished capacity defense. Well, that ruling was an abuse of discretion because Kenya never raised a diminished capacity defense. Dr. Harder's testimony was admissible under NRS 50.275 because it would have assisted the trier of fact to understand the evidence or to determine a fact and issue. And in this case, those issues were justification and specific intent. And on those issues, the state is the one that bore the burden of proof. As to whether the battery was justified, Kenya's IQ was relevant both to the subjective and the objective elements of that defense. Testimony that Kenya had difficulty processing information would have helped establish the first two completely subjective elements of the Runyon test. That's that he had an honest belief that his mother was in danger, and two, that he acted solely upon those beliefs. And that's subjective. It would have also helped establish the reasonability element as well, and this is under the Pineda case. That element is satisfied if a person in the circumstances and from the viewpoint of the defendant would reasonably have believed that he or another was in imminent danger. Kenya was not an ordinary man who ran into his mother's bedroom that night. He was a man with a 61 IQ, and he's going to review his surroundings very differently than an average person. So it was appropriate for the jury to consider his viewpoint and whether his viewpoint was reasonable.
But isn't that then asking the jury to say that he lacks the capacity to form the
independent. I don't believe that it's saying we're not instructing. See, the difference between asking for a diminished capacity instruction, which tells the jury how it's supposed to interpret the facts that they're being presented with, and what the defense was trying to do in this case was to present the evidence, merely the evidence that he had a 61 IQ, so that the jury could consider that as it was evaluating the state's burden. And that's why, you know, for a similar reason, this court reversed in the Donovan Matthews case, because the district court in that case didn't really understand what the purpose was that the defense was using that evidence for. And the evidence was actually being used to refute an element of the state's case. Here, the way self-defense operates, once you have entitled yourself to that jury instruction, then it becomes the state's burden. And so really it's just evidence that the jury can consider along with all of the other evidence in reaching the conclusion, did he or did he not actually believe, or was he not reasonable in those beliefs?
So, but I think you're arguing that even under the objective part of the test, I'm looking about whether a reasonable person would have felt there was a threat to themselves or others. You're saying to evaluate as part of that reasonableness, not just whether anyone would have felt threatened, but whether somebody with a 61 IQ would have felt threatened.
Correct. And I think it's because it's not actually a strict reasonable person standard. You're evaluating the reasonableness of a person who is in the shoes of the defendant. And we know this because, and this kind of comes back to, there's a distinction between the model instruction in Runyon and the language in that instruction, and then 4 years later, the court in Pineda, also on Bonk, there's a discrepancy in the language. And so the Runyon instruction, that third element says, you know, it has to be a reasonable person in a similar situation who would believe himself to be in like danger. But one of the things the court made clear in Runyon was that is not, that instruction is not a stock instruction that should be used for everything.
Right.
You know, the court has to tailor instructions for the facts of each given case. And then in Pineda, the en banc court said that an instruction on reasonableness, which did take into account the defendant's own viewpoint, was consistent with that sample instruction. So I think you have to synthesize those two instructions, and you can do that by interpreting Runyon and evaluating it as a reasonable person in a similar situation. So you're looking at a person who is in the similar situation of the defendant. That would also account for the defendant's IQ. You have to look at that when you're looking at the similar situation. So I don't believe that it is a strict reasonable person standard. I think you can synthesize the two cases. So what does it mean in practice? Well, I mean, in Pineda, this court allowed an expert to testify about gang culture because the defendant in that case had a personal experience with gang culture. So we had an expert that came in and said what this meant is that the defendant's belief that the victims were armed, even if it wasn't a correct belief, it was a reasonable belief. So that expert testimony was admissible on the reasonableness issue. In Daniel, the court said, a defendant's knowledge of a victim's violent tendencies is relevant to the belief in the need for self-defense and whether that's reasonable. Similarly, with battered women's syndrome, in Boykins, the court has said, battered women's syndrome is relevant to whether the defendant reasonably believed in the need to act in self-defense. So here, I would say that the outcome should be similar, that Kenya's 61 IQ, his circumstances had to be considered by the jury in evaluating whether his response and whether his beliefs were reasonable. But moving on to the specific intent issues, the expert testimony was admissible to refute the state's claim that Kenya was consciously and deliberately conspiring with his mother and manipulating his mother and stepfather to prevent them from testifying at the preliminary hearing. And the state in this case relied heavily in closing on the fact that Kenya had placed over 200 calls to his mother between July 29th, 2019 and March 6th, 2020, which was in the middle of trial. They were claiming he was trying to trick his parents and mislead them about the law of subpoenas, their Fifth Amendment rights, et cetera. But if the jury had known that he had a 61 IQ, that same evidence would be viewed in an entirely different way. Instead of seeing this manipulative monster, they may have seen Kenya as an adult child who can't stop calling his mom. I mean, he was pretty much calling her every single day. And not all of those calls even had anything to do necessarily with the case. The state didn't even
Can I just ask about that conspiracy? I'm sorry, Justice Stiglitz, why don't you go ahead? I'll wait.
I'm sorry, two quick questions, Ms. Westbrook, or two areas I want you to address. One, the admission of the plea, the discussion about the plea negotiations with his mother. And two, I want to make sure there's time for you to address his sentencing concerns related to Zoom.
Sure. Okay. So the plea related statements. Find where I have that in my notes. Essentially, the statute. Well, first of all, you're not allowed to present evidence of sentencing at all during the trial about the sentence that somebody might be serving. So it's very problematic that the jury heard on two separate occasions these phone calls. Once was in opening, and once was in the middle of the trial itself. That the state's offering a 2-5. They're offering a 2-5. They're offering a 2-5. I mean, this is not something that generally the jury is even allowed to consider. And it should not. I mean, that easily could have been redacted out, but it was not. And there was, it's not part of the res geste. There's no reason the state, even in its closing argument PowerPoint, never mentioned the 2-5 as part of its basis for why he needed to be, why he was conspiring. But it was completely irrelevant, completely extraneous. It shouldn't have come in. But in terms of the statute, NRS 48.125, subsection 1 is clear. Evidence of an offer to plead guilty or guilty but mentally ill to a crime charged or any other crime is not admissible in a criminal proceeding. So, I mean, it should not have come in this case at all, whether or not it was part of I addressed in the briefing the fact that it was part of negotiations. I mean, he was aware that the state had made the offer. He's considering the negotiation. So under Mann, I think it also does, it is the type of statement, unlike in the cases where you have somebody off suggesting to the DAs, suggesting to the police, I think it was one of the state's cases that they had cited where it was during the police interrogation, he initiates it. This isn't him initiating, to try to get a deal. This is the state has actually offered a deal. So that's, that shouldn't have come in at all. And the fact that he ended up receiving habitual criminal, treatment, the jury might not have been, clearly wasn't aware, and it may have played a role, notwithstanding the jury instructions that were given. So I think, Justice Stiglitz, you had also asked about the sentencing issue. Was that? So over Kenya's objection, the district court sentenced him, and he wanted to appear in person. His attorney objected and said, you can't see him. He's not visible on the monitor. And the court said instead, you know what? I don't think I need to see him. I can sentence him. We can sentence him today. The DA in this case, to their credit, they actually suggested that the case be postponed and that sentencing occur at a later time. And the court wasn't willing to do that.
So can you just explain what was actually happening? Could anybody be seen on the screen? He just couldn't? Like, what was actually the situation?
So I guess this would sort of be getting outside of what's in the record. I can tell you that I did see the video, and there was a frozen person. I don't know if it was the defendant, just kind of standing there. And it was, so it wasn't, it may have been a prior in custody person.
Do we have that, is it Jabs?
No, the Jabs were not submitted to the court, but the district court did state on the record, acknowledged that she couldn't see him. I don't think there's a dispute as to whether he was visible, and the state can see
him. The attorneys could be seen and could see each other and the court and vice versa? Is it your understanding the attorneys could see the court and the court could see the attorneys, just not Mr. Lattimore, is that?
I think the attorneys were in court on this occasion.
Oh.
So he was the only one appearing. He was the only one appearing remotely.
Okay. Thank you.
But I appear to be running out of time, so I guess I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Brandon Albright, and I was one of the trial attorneys on this case. I'll attempt, given the time restraints, to kind of respond to all three or four of the issues that appellant counsel spoke about. So in turn, I guess I'll go in reverse order so we can hit them. Very quickly, Judge Kadish, it's important to note that, yes, Justice Kadish, that Both attorneys, Shannon Clowers and myself, were present in court. This was at the very kind of beginning of phase two. Defense counsel, both of them were present in court. The victim was present in court, Mary, the defendant's mother, and Carl, Carl was the victim, Mary was the mother. They were both present in court. She was wheeled in a wheelchair. It was very touching.
She was listed as a victim on a dissuasion count.
Correct, Your Honor. So they were both present in court. And that day, I was also present, and as I just said, that Jabs froze, but you could clearly hear everything from the jail side and vice versa. So it's important to note that although the state had no problem, and we put that on the record, continuing it, that's under the judge's discretion. So I don't think it kind of makes a difference that we as the state said, yeah, we don't mind continuing it, because Judge Bluth was ready to go forward that day. She also put on the record that she could clearly hear the defendant and take into account everything that he had to say. It's important to note that he did make a statement, and he spoke at length. In fact, that during the sentencing and in the record, defense counsel's argument at sentencing was 14 pages long. They spoke at length about his IQ, his criminal record. Then Mary spoke, like I said, and so did Carl. And then the defendant said his piece. What distinguishes this, and very quickly I'll say this, in terms of this case specifically, because it was kind of telephonic or just audio and not video, and it's interesting that Justice Stiglitz would be the one to ask that since she's not here today. And she's actually not seen on video. She's only here telephonically. And I think that's important because obviously by the fact that we've been doing this for a year now, this court arguably believes that that's as persuasive during oral argument as if she was here personally, because we're allowing that to happen.
But if a court is looking at a defendant and having to decide what sentence to impose, and in this case, not only considering the normal range, but a habitual range, don't you think there's some value to the court actually seeing the defendant's expression to understand if he's actually feeling remorseful or, you know, how he acts in court, especially when making a sentencing decision for 20 years in prison?
And I absolutely appreciate that question, Justice Kadish. And what's important here is I think you're distinguishing between telephonic versus audiovisual. Is that fair to say?
Well, at a minimum, yes.
Okay. And so in the briefing here, United States v. Williams, it's a Sixth Circuit case back in 2011, they argue, the appellant, that being physically present in the courtroom with another person, a certain intangible and difficult to articulate effects that are wholly absent when communicating by video conference. Again, I would lean on the fact that for a year now, this court has heard oral arguments without being present, which kind of speaks to the power of being able just to hear or see somebody on a screen. I'll also say this, that this court is aware that the vast majority of sentencings in district court happen by way of unconditional waiver, preliminary hearing, entering into a GPA in front of a master calendar, and then the first time that person sees the judge is at sentencing. Right. And all that judge has is a PSI, which includes their criminal record and a 1 to 2 paragraph synopsis of the crime. This is not this case. Judge Bluth had this case from its inception in district court. For nearly a year, she was present for every hearing,
counsel?
Every status check, all the litigation. Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, this is Justice Stiglitz. I don't necessarily think we can conflate, you know, my appearance over Zoom with a defendant's due process right to a fair and just hearing. Because in due process, we're looking at it, to some extent, you know, from his perspective, what process have we afforded him? And certainly the norm has been here, both statutory, certainly there's statute to the statute, to our case law, that in-person has been the norm. COVID shook that a bit. I think the question that's an understatement, but the question here is, was just having audio just a bridge too far? Does he feel like that was fair? Objectively, can we say that was fair? When he didn't even ask to wait till COVID was over, he just said, hey, I want to be able to see, and I want the judge to be able to see me. And the state, as I understood, didn't object to just kind of getting that behind them.
Thank you, Justice Stiglitz. I meant no offense by kind of pointing out that you weren't here. I understand kind of
the situation
we're in. But I think it's important to note that in this court's wisdom, Administrative Order 20-17 was filed, and it's important the timeline there. That was filed a week before the sentencing in this case. And so this court realized the pickle, for lack of a different term, that we were in terms of COVID, that it wasn't going away anytime soon, but that justice delayed is justice denied, and that things, and in fact, in that order, it said that one of the reasons for that ordering was to prevent an excessive backlog of cases. That was on line 23, page 2 of that administrative order. One of the reasons we did that was to not indefinitely continue all of these cases, including trials, sentencings, and anything else that would require them to be in person. In that same administrative order, it says that in Halberstam v. Hardesty, the chief judge has inherent power to take actions reasonably necessary to administer justice efficiently, fairly, and economically. And that was you, Justice Pickering, that signed that, basically saying that extraordinary measures are necessary for extraordinary situations, meaning during COVID, we can't just push a pause button and have this backlog. I mean, we're going to deal with the trials that didn't happen for the last year for many, many years to come. So, again, in the court's wisdom, I think...
Counsel, if I may interrupt you...
Absolutely, Justice.
In your point, I get your point, but the issue that Justice Stiglitz just asked you about is the distinction between viewing someone or their ability to view you and the audio. Is that a bridge too far?
Absolutely.
I mean, all of the things you've recounted we're familiar with, and those measures were significant and necessary at the time, but they didn't say you couldn't continue sentencing for a day or two so we can fix the JAVs so you can see the guy.
Fair enough, Your Honor. And my response to that is this. This case, like I said, is very different than most cases in the fact that Judge Bluth was very familiar with this defendant.
I'm sorry for interrupting.
Absolutely.
The other point I wanted to get to, and it has to do with how we interpret NRS 178-388, which seems to call for presence. How do we interpret that statute? Is presence required? Physical presence required? Is video presence adequate? Is audio presence sufficient? And how do we distinguish those? That seems to me to be the issue that is percolated in this case and the one before it.
I believe video, audio-visual is certainly allowable, certainly under the emergency powers that I mentioned earlier, the administrative order. Mm-hmm. And in terms of solely telephonic, I think it's important to note in the administrative order, in foreseeing technical difficulties arising, this court said that alternative means appearances included telephonic were there to be disruptions. So I think this court knew that that might be an issue. But the difference here, I think it's important, is that, again, Judge Bluth had sat through a week-long trial. She was familiar with this person, had sat through a year of litigation.
Did he testify at trial?
No, he did not.
Okay, so she probably hadn't seen him say a whole lot in court up to that point, right?
The defendant personally?
Yes.
He spoke at length during various litigation motions. He was always in court physically because that was pre-COVID.
Yes.
COVID only happened about a week after trial, just in timeline's sake. So in terms of the difference between telephonic and video, audiovisual, I think harmless error is the argument here. And the reason it comes into play here is that difference, that how much time and face time Judge Bluth had with this defendant. And she made it clear from the get-go before sentencing, I will take into consideration everything he has to say. There's also a case on point that we mentioned in our brief on Reynolds v. State. This court did not reverse on the grounds that a sentencing judge with the defendant present in court made a ruling, and then after, out of his presence, further thought on the case, and the JOC reflected a harsher sentence. So I think that is relevant and on point here, that something happened outside of his presence, that face-to-face didn't change that, and a harsher sentence reflected after that.
Well, it's an interesting side note, because in the rural communities with difficult broadband connections, it's not unsurprising that video is a difficult issue. So when you're talking about a case of potential import for the entire state, we don't get to talk about broadband difficulties, but certainly a pragmatic problem. I'm sorry we're consuming your time.
No, that's okay. And I think that's an important case, to something to point out. In terms of most of the cases that they mention in terms of arguing audiovisual is not sufficient, date back either two decades, the most recent dating back to 2011, which is a decade. And I think it goes without saying that technology in terms of audiovisual appearances have come a long way in the last 10 years versus something that was akin to freezing over and over again and not hearing them to now we have FaceTime on our phone and it's in full 4K or 1080 HD. With that, I'll move on to the diminished capacity defense. So,
but I want to pause you before you move
absolutely.
On. It makes a difference to the harmless error analysis whether it's his right to be present, assuming he has such a right, is derived constitutionally or from a statute. And I'd like you to comment on the constitutional argument she's making with respect to the defendant's right to effectively deliver his allocution to a person live and in person.
And again, I apologize if this is repetitive, but I think this court's administrative order, part of the purpose that was filed was to at least take care of that issue while we can. I don't know if that'll be a permanent fixture, but certainly I think this court decided while we're in this situation, constitutionally, this court has the right to make sure that things can be done in a way that we don't make that backlog happen. So I still argue that Administrative Order 2017, which was issued the week before the sentencing, covered the fact that him appearing audiovisually and thereby even telephonically by harmless error did not violate his constitutional rights.
Thank you.
In terms of his, and I'll try to hurry through this, I know I'm short on time, but the diminished capacity, defense wants to argue that they're not arguing diminished capacity simply by calling it by a different name. I think Crawford v. State is directly on point here because in their appeal, they said, they try to use NRS 50.275 by saying that a expert witness is allowed to assist the trier of fact to understand the evidence, and they repeatedly say it's the assistance requirement. In Crawford v. State in 2005, this court said, Crawford argues that he is entitled to instructions providing guidance to the jury to consider the evidence he presented respecting his diminished capacity. We reject Crawford's contention. That's on page 757. So this sounds very similar. That this court did not allow instructions providing guidance to the jury, which is exactly what appellate counsel wants to happen here. They want to have an expert be able to assist the jury in understanding why his diminished capacity, they never use that term in their briefs, they call it a low IQ, to understand why he did what he did. And in fact, in pages 28 through 30 in their opening brief, there's things such as, quote, a person with an IQ of 61 might have reasonably believed so-and-so. Kenya, with his limited intellect, would have not understood. When the court prevented Kenya from introducing evidence of his low IQ at trial, he was unable to meaningfully respond to the state's
argument.
But, counsel,
to the extent that state of mind of Mr. Lattimore is an element of the self-defense defense and specific intent required to dissuade a witness, even though our case law doesn't allow diminished capacity defense or our statutes don't, we clearly allow evidence that's pertinent to mens rea. And that's the argument I think they're making. So why isn't it relevant there?
So, and they did. They brought up Runyon and a reasonable person in a similar situation. And they want to say that the similar situation is not kind of the physical surroundings, but his mental state, or rather his IQ. But
well, it wasn't just physical surroundings in that other case. It was the fact that he's got gang experience that would make him perceive something as a threat that wouldn't otherwise be a threat. Isn't that what Pineda is?
Absolutely. So Pineda v. State, and there's an important distinction here, Your Honor. The experience in gang culture, which created this fear in him, was rational because of his experience. It also is a reasonable everyman standard. Anybody in that situation would fear a known gang member. But he's saying that his diminished capacity wouldn't allow him to do that. They're basically saying that the appellant isn't a reasonable person. So how do we apply a reasonable person standard, to somebody that they're basically saying cannot make a reasonable or rational decision? I believe it's a self-defeating argument, is what I'm saying.
So if we talk about reasonableness under the circumstances, someone with a 61 IQ is held to the standard of someone with your average IQ.
That's why we don't believe in or don't follow diminished capacity in the state.
Okay. And what about in terms of dissuading a witness where you have to have, Chief, can
go
I
ahead.
Go ahead?
Yes, of course.
Can you, it's you have to have specific intent to that what you're trying to do is keep that person from cooperating and coming Absolutely. And testifying. So wouldn't it be helpful for the jury to understand that what this man's actual intellectual capacity is in evaluating what he intended when he said these words?
I think it's important in terms of his low IQ. I don't think it's refuted that he has an IQ of 61, quite frankly. Okay. But under Ibarra v. State and comparing this appellant to Ibarra, Ibarra had a lower IQ. The adaptive functioning is what's truly important here. Ibarra, who was also found not incompetent.
It's not an Atkins case.
What's that, Your Honor?
We're not in an Atkins case.
No, but what I'm saying is when arguing about Ibarra and the argument that they could argue that he didn't understand what he was doing, the adaptive function is important, whereas Ibarra couldn't function in society, period. He couldn't hold a job. He couldn't get married. He couldn't go on a walk without getting lost. This defendant, Kenny Lattimore, has six kids. He's worked for 20 years as a chef in the culinary business. He takes care of his mom, allegedly. They brought up the competency evaluation, and that's on page 204 of the record. Dr. Daniel Sussman, just 2 months before trial, said that he had an average intelligence. And I think that's not based on his IQ, but a face-to-face conversation where you're asking somebody not math-based and science-based questions, but what do you like to do? Do you understand the process of what's going on? And based on that evaluation, a doctor found that he had an average intelligence.
So he has the ability to appear and sound like he has a higher IQ than he actually does have.
Exactly, because there's a
Wouldn't
difference
that be
between...
helpful for the jury to know?
No, and I think that's the difference between a functional, and that's made clear in Ibarra, functional, adaptive functioning and intellectual functioning. Book smarts versus street smarts. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference here. I would argue that the appellant is very street smart, given his lengthy criminal history and how much he has managed to accomplish in the situation he was given versus Ibarra.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, just a second. We had a lot of questions. Are there any questions of counsel on other issues that he didn't get to?
I can address the speaking over the telephone about the sentencing, if that's important to Judge Stiglitz or Justice Stiglitz.
Justice Stiglitz, do you have any additional questions on the sentencing?
I don't, Chief. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you to the court.
And Ms. Westbrook will give you an additional 2 minutes of time for your
Thank
rebuttal.
You, Your Honor. So I know we just talked a little bit about Administrative Order 2017, which had just gone into effect a couple of weeks before this sentencing procedure took place. And if you actually look at the language in Administrative Order 2017, the section on in-custody defendants, it says, all in-custody defendants will appear by video to the assigned judicial departments for law and motion calendar. A couple sentences later, it says, except for jury trials, no defendant will be transported to a district court courtroom absent extraordinary circumstances. I want to look at those two requirements, a requirement that the in-custody will appear by video and a provision for transport in extraordinary circumstances. Well, what we had here, if you look at Merriam-Webster's online dictionary, the ordinary meaning of the word appear is to be or to come in sight. So that requires something visual. It's undisputed that the video was not working on the day that Kenya was sentenced. That would be an extraordinary circumstance that would have entitled him to appear and to be brought physically into the courtroom.
Are you arguing that if he had been able to appear by audiovisual, say if they got the technical difficulties worked out and got him the next day for AV, would that be sufficient?
I don't believe it would be sufficient. And what I want to say about the administrative order is that, you know, the court does have the right, obviously, to administrate and take care of administrative matters and pass rules that address those things. But as the court recognized in Halverson versus Hardcastle, inherent judicial power is not infinite and it has to be exercised within the confines of valid existing law. So what that means is that we need to interpret this administrative order in a way that will comport with his federal and state constitutional rights to appear in person at sentencing. And basically what that means is that if he asserts his right, if as he did here, you know, I mean, Kenya could have rights can be waived. Constitutional rights can be waived, you know, the right to appearance. You know, recently the court recognized that a defendant could waive that right. In this case, Kenya didn't waive the right. He asserted it. And when that happens, that means that the court has to do something other than what's in the administrative
order. Sorry, so I just want to be clear. He asked to be able to be seen on video as opposed to a request to be in person.
No, it was the objection was to sentencing remotely and also because the video wasn't working.
Your argument that it has to be in person or that he had to be seen on video?
No, my argument is that it had to be in person because he asked for in person. And it's important because, there's both a Sixth Amendment right to presence and a due process right to presence. And in the context of sentencing, what really matters is that right, to be there at a phase of the trial where your absence could render it less fair. This is the last opportunity that he had to come face to face with the judge, for the judge to look him in the eye as she's pronouncing sentence. And
Ms. Westbrook, sorry for interrupting, but we're short on time and I wanted to raise this issue. Justice Pickering asked an important question of your opponent, and I'd like to ask it of you. Is this constitutionally based? And if so, what's the basis?
It's 100% constitutionally based. Yes. I mean, the court has said.
Provision of the Constitution.
It's the due process and Sixth Amendment. There's both a Sixth Amendment and a due process basis for the right to presence. And so in this case, the court has said if
because there's some federal circuit cases that don't agree with that. The reason I bring it up.
Okay, I mean, this court has already said a sentencing hearing is a critical stage, and in Reynolds, the court actually did state that it was a critical phase at which point the defendant had the right to appear. Now, the state has just tried to distinguish Reynolds because there was a subsequent sentencing, like a change in the sentence that occurred after, but what mattered in Reynolds was that he physically appeared. He did physically appear in court. So I do believe that this is a constitutional issue.
We've also held there's no confrontation right at sentencing.
Of course, so the due process aspect is absolutely, I mean, that's what the court said in Williams. Seeing a video screen is different than seeing a live human. Williams being physically present in the same room with another has certain intangible and difficult to articulate effects that are wholly absent when communicating by video. I mean, a judge can be psychologically distant from the defendant when, if you don't have to look at somebody, it's like, breaking up with someone over the telephone. It's easier to do. It's easier to do something harsh when you don't have to look the person in the eye. So that's why I do believe it is a constitutional right. It would be, in this case, a due process right for him to appear.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Westbrook.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I have one more question.
Yes, Justice Pickering.
There are cases addressing judges who are visually impaired. How do you address those in your analysis?
I had not thought about that particular issue, but at least I think there's a sense that the defendant would be able to be in the same room with the judge.
And read the judge's body language.
There would be a benefit from that perspective, I think. But that's why being in court, being there, having, being there when judgment is pronounced, I think is so important.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you, Chief.
Thank you both for excellent briefing and your arguments today. Yes, let's take a 5-minute